You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa ko Kaden toku ingoa. No mai haere mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rāpare Thursday. My name is Kaden, I'm your host today, and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in studio by producer Caster, who will be reading for Otto. Whai Akine coming up on the show, I speak to Labour Deputy Leader Carmel Cipollone about last week's Labour Party conference and scrutiny week in Parliament. I speak to Kanak Youth Coordinator Vero Suale about the struggle for decolonisation in New Caledonia. I also speak to University of Auckland lecturer Dr. Emmy Van Esch about the ethics of monitoring employees' computers when they work from home. And I speak to World Vision's Dr. Olivia Yates about Pacific migration due to climate change. Caster reading as Otto, what have you got for us today?
I speak to Dr. Selena Shang from the University of Auckland about the government's decision to remove agricultural emissions from the emissions trading scheme. And I also speak to Dr. Jennifer Tatebe from the University of Auckland to talk about the impact of urbanisation on rural schools.
He aha o whakaro. I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch, tuku pātuki mai, text it on 5395 or wire mai rane. Give us a call in studio on 309-3879. Ka awa e wariwari e hahi ana koutou te whakanongo ki ene kōrero ano he pakeheri rokiroki mārunga i te pai tukutuku o Erirangi Pōho me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website 95BFM.com. Text rima toru iwa rima 5395 or call toru kore iwa toru waru fitu iwa 309-3879. Now let's get into the show.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party.
Labour had their Lower North Island Regional Conference over the weekend, where leader Chris Hipkins spoke to what kind of opposition he wanted the party to be. It came ahead of Scrutiny Week in Parliament. Scrutiny Week is a chance for the opposition to analyse the budget line by line with a fine-tooth comb and raise any questions or concerns in front of a more than usual public eye. I spoke about what kind of opposition Labour had become and what we have learnt in Scrutiny Week for our weekly catch-up with Labour Deputy Leader Carmel Cipollone. Over the weekend, the Leader of the Opposition said Labour needs to be a very effective opposition. What does this look like?
I think it looks like what we've seen over the course of the last few days, actually, holding the government to account during Scrutiny Week, interrogating their every decision, pulling out the finer detail, which quite often the government is very quick to forget or to present to the public. And also, engaging on the ground with our communities, with our stakeholders, that's what we can do well in opposition. We've got the time to do that. We need to be out there listening, meeting with people, garnering their ideas. And then at some point comes the time where we present our ideas to the country with the hope that they will elect us at the next election.
Things that were mentioned at the Labour Party conference were filling in the government's gaps on things like tax cuts and cancer drugs. But what sets Labour's vision apart from Nationals?
Well, our vision has always been for an inclusive, fairer, prosperous Aotearoa. Right now, in terms of our policy, well, it's too early in the election cycle for us to present that. And we're working hard at holding the government to account. It is important. You know, so many people elected this government on the promise of $250 a fortnight for tax cuts. Well, very few families got that. So many New Zealanders supported this government because they thought they were going to get one of 13 new cancer drugs that the government promised before the election. And now we don't know whether we're going to get that. So this is an important job, part of the job in opposition as well, holding the government to account for things that they say that they would do when they don't do them.
And can you talk a bit about what you have been up to for Scrutiny Week this week?
Yeah, sure. So I had, I think, 10 out of the 11 social services hearings yesterday I sat in on. Some of the big ones, social development, Oranga Tamariki, associate housing, who has responsibility for social housing and emergency housing. Also, another big one, the Whaikaha, with regards to the Ministry for Disabled People. So lots of important kaupapa and lots of important questions asked of those ministers.
Can you talk a little bit more about areas of the budget you have raised concerns on this week?
Yeah, well, lots of areas where there have been cuts, where there has been deprioritisation of things that we think the government should be prioritising. One of many areas that I was able to hit up this week was around the government's decision to continue with the minimum wage exemption, which sees about 900 disabled people across the country get paid sometimes as low as $2 an hour. I've really disliked the minister's representation of what Labor's policy was, because we actually had planned on subsidising those employers so they could pay the minimum wage to these workers. Now the government's saving themselves over $11 million a year by not providing that subsidy to those employers so that those disabled people can get paid the minimum wage, which flies against, you know, our obligations to the UN Convention and basically just something that is right. And so hitting the minister up about a misrepresentation of that policy and her decision to get rid of it has been really important.
You have to ask why, right? What was the minister's reasoning for doing this?
The minister keeps saying publicly that these people deserve to have jobs and she doesn't want to see them out of a job. What she conveniently does not mention is that the policy entailed the government providing a subsidy to the employers to support them to actually pay those workers the minimum wage. So the brunt of the cost was actually going to be held by the government as opposed to those employers. And work needed to be undertaken to ensure that the employers or the business was still sustainable and that those people could work. But no one ever had the intention of seeing the 900 people that are currently receiving the minimum wage exemption out of work. And so her deliberate attempt to leave out the detail constantly was something that I was able to hit her up about yesterday.
Could not subsidising the wages keep members of disabled communities locked into poverty?
Well, it's just everyone deserves to work with dignity. And we have a group of New Zealanders here who are disabled, who are receiving, the only New Zealanders who are receiving less than the minimum wage. And so, you know, it's the lack of dignity in work and also our obligation to make sure that there is no group, cohort, you know, no people in this country that are treated less than anyone else. And we understand the constraints on some of those businesses, which is why we proposed the subsidy to support the businesses to pay these workers the right amount of money. And so we are highly disappointed that the minister and the government have done this turnaround and have removed the policy that Labor introduced.
I will just note, they're not the only New Zealanders who can be paid less than minimum wage. 16 and 17-year-olds can also be paid a starting out wage, so maybe that needs to be looked into as well.
This is true, actually, Caden. This is true.
But this week's Scrutiny Week also had a rule change. Has it been more effective than previous years?
Well, this is the first time that we've had Scrutiny Week. I think in some ways it was very useful. I think that there's some things that could be tweaked. We had one minister, for instance, his name is Tama Pōtaka, who basically refused to follow the rules and answer the questions. The day before, Chris Bishop had said that a particular part of the housing portfolio was Tama Pōtaka's responsibility. Tama came in and said, nah, not my responsibility, it's Chris Bishop's. You know, that was disappointing because that was our opportunity to scrutinise him, and he just would not answer the questions. On top of that, when he did answer questions, he filibustered and just spoke and spoke and spoke, which really impacted and impeded our ability to be able to scrutinise and interrogate the minister. So I do think we need to review it. I actually think that there needs to be some recourse where ministers are not following the rules, with regards to the scrutiny sessions, because at the moment I don't believe there is. And so I think that could be something that could be looked at.
There's been some discussions that there was a lot, if not too much, political theatre this week. Would you agree with this?
Oh, there certainly was some political theatre. I would agree with that. But again, a little bit of political theatre is fine as long as everyone is adhering to the intention of the process that's been set up. And I worry that there were some that certainly did not adhere to that. And so that's why I think that a follow-up needs to be, what is the measure that can be taken by the opposition in the event that the minister refuses to adhere to the kaupapa of what Scrutiny Week is about and the rules that ensue.
That was Labor Deputy Leader Kamal Sipaloni on shaping Labor's opposition and Scrutiny Week in Parliament.
That was our weekly chat with the Labor Party.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
New Caledonia has been dominating headlines recently for ongoing riots and Indigenous opposition against an attempt from France to tighten their political control over the territory. I spoke to Indigenous Kanak Youth Coordinator Vero Hule about recent developments in their fight against French rule on this issue and more generally. We also spoke about his comments that New Zealanders, especially Māori, should be standing in solidarity with the Kanak people. He encourages everyone to write to their MPs in support of New Caledonian independence from France and to also organise and attend rallies for this cause. I started by asking what the current situation in Noumea is.
Okay. Actually, the situation here in New Caledonia, there is a lot of anger, hatred, and above all, a great feeling of injustice here. This is currently, for me, a recolonization of Nikanaki, New Caledonia, by the sitting of the French army and more than 1,000 police force from France. And France can be considered to be an opposition in a position of arm, forced favorable to the recolonization of my country, and France does not wish to dialogue but to impose itself and reprimand the Kanak people and thus subjugate them once again through colonization. Furthermore, actually the situation here, Macron does not wish to publicly admit that he lost the fight against the Kanak youth, who are strongly committed and active for the decolonization of the country and the accession to full sovereignty and independence of Kanak, New Caledonia. One, the question of a withdrawal of the constitutional bill which admitted Kanak, New Caledonia. Because today he has lost the support of the National Assembly, the Senate in France, and the support of the far right of Marine Le Pen. He cannot as well, he cannot convene the Versailles Congress because he no longer has a majority, and he cannot ask for a national referendum because that will mean an anti-Macron vote. And actually, we don't have any National Assembly because he canceled the National Assembly. We got a new election in France in 13th on June to elect our new representative.
Can you talk a bit more about what you mean by recolonization and what the Kanak youth are aiming to achieve and how they're pushing back against the French?
Recolonization because they don't respect the Nouméa Accord. The Nouméa Accord is one of the biggest accord in New Caledonia. That's why we have a big peace here in New Caledonia since 1998. And the Nouméa Accord is the goal of the Nouméa Accord is to decolonize. It's a process of decolonization. So the independentists and the Kanak people, they consider the attack from the French army and the police like a recolonization of the home country. because the real objective of the Nouméa Accord is the decolonization and to give the sovereignty at the Kanaky New Caledonia. And as well, like I said, Macron does not wish to publicly admit that he lost the fight against the Kanak youth, who are strongly committed and active for the decolonization of the country. And it's always about the question of the withdrawal of constitutional bill. It's mean that if they open the reform about the electoral reform, it's mean that we accept all the people from France to vote for the decolonization. But it's impossible for Kanak because to let the settlers decide for them if the country is decolonized or not.
And how can or should New Zealanders be supporting what Kanak youth are doing?
The only things we can accept from New Zealand, the indigenous Kanak people and the Caledonian community, that they contribute. One has an unconditional support for the indigenous Kanak people in the process of decolonization of the territory, because Kanaky New Caledonia is included on the UN list of 17 territories to be decolonized. And the country here need an emergency assistance from the UN in the territory, and that the UN be designed as the body for a dialogue mission in New Caledonia, because France is no longer impartial, and this could lead to even greater tensions. And we need a support from the country for the next C24 summit, the summit of decolonization of the UN, and at the UN General Assembly in support through the adoption of a resolution in favor of the decolonization and the sovereignty and independence of the Kanak people and the country's accession to a full sovereignty and independence. And we need humanitarian help here in Kanaky, New Caledonia. And as well, if it's possible to have a good relation with Maori people, to our brother, because we are linked with our ancestors, with the Maori people, because we are one people, one moana here. And we need their support to bring our voice to people in Aotearoa to say what's really happened here, because my people, Kanak people and Maori people, they are one people here in the Pacific Ocean, because we got the same ancestors.
Is there anything else you want New Zealand listeners to know about the situation for the Kanak people and also how they can support?
Actually, we cannot have more support from New Zealand, because New Zealand have some interest with the French government across the army, but we need to have the support from New Zealand for an official support from their government, an official support from the government for the Committee of Decolonization of our territory at the C24 in the UN. We really need help from them. And if they can call the UN for an emergency assistance from the UN, it will be really great for our country. Because here we are really afraid about the French police and French army and the injustice from the French government. And as well, we need the help from the New Zealand and Aotearoa specifically, because we got here some group. We call them the militia terrorist anti-Kanak, sent by the French settlers to kill and shoot Kanak people in the street. We already have 17 young people who passed away, and two soldiers who passed away since the riot began.
That was Kanak Youth Coordinator Viro Huale on the fight to decolonise New Caledonia. He encourages everyone to write to their MPs in support of New Caledonian independence from France and to also organise and attend rallies for the cause.
Well, what a phenomenal thing for you to say.
The Wire.
We'll be right back after a short break. Keep it on the B.
The early bird gets the worm, and the early 95 BFM listener gets a good spot at Bestie Cafe for 95 BFM's Breakfast Club in St. Kevin's Arcade, Friday, June 21 from 7 till 10 a.m.
Join the breakfast team at Bestie Cafe and help us say bon voyage to Rachel with a special live broadcast featuring music from Jim Nothing and CCTV, a live Hobby Goblins, second guessing and weather from the one and only Rick Breeze.
Breakfast Club with Rachel at Bestie Cafe from 7 till 10 a.m. Friday, June 21.
R.I.P. Middens. She's gone. At least I have these photos to remember her. Look, her first steps.
Aww.
Eating her first bird.
Ew.
And her last moment. I call this one raspberry jelly.
Ugh, why? What?
Damn that car.
What is that shining in the gutter?
Her beautiful angelic eye.
Pro Gear Photographic. For photos that'll bring out the light in your eyes, no matter the circumstance. Head to Pro Gear for all your photography needs. Open now at 3 Railway Street, Newmarket, or go to progear.co.nz.
Hello, Ms. Toucan. Morning, Mr. Sloth. Mrs. Sloth. And how are you, Mr. Big, Scary, Ferocious Lion?
You never know what you'll find on the BFM Kids Show, bringing stories, songs, games, and all kinds of fun to your Sunday morning since forever ago.
The 95 BFM Kids Show with Lee and Finn, 7 till 9 every Sunday morning. Brought to you by the New Zealand Maritime Museum. Hui te ananui a Tangaroa.
Is it too late in the process, though, to change that?
Nothing's too late, bro. Everything's made up in politics.
The Wire.
Last week, the government announced that it would remove agricultural emissions from the New Zealand Emissions Trading Scheme and establish a new pastoral sector group to tackle emissions within the industry. The move was widely criticised by conservationists and climate activists, who say that the agricultural sector is one of the largest contributors to the country's net greenhouse gas emissions, and that the move would remove incentives for industry players to decarbonise their practices. However, a team of researchers at the Energy Centre in the University of Auckland's Department of Economics recently conducted a study on the emissions trading scheme and had a different perspective to offer. Osho spoke to Dr. Selena Shang, one of the co-authors of the study, to discuss her take on the government's decision.
Has New Zealand's emissions trading scheme been effective in helping the country meet its emissions mitigation goals?
Yes. Our study just found out that actually the New Zealand emissions trading scheme effectively reduces emissions on a broader scale. But from the empirical studies that we've got is that it's falling to spur economic expansion and also reduce emissions simultaneously by sectors. So that's what we found.
Would you say that the ETS has been successful in giving businesses the incentive to switch to lower carbon practices?
Actually, what we found is that there are five key sectors that were not actually performing well. Those are the factors are underperforming. So what we've got is that agriculture, transport, energy, petroleum and diesel, and also waste, those five key sectors are not contributing as effectively as they could be to the country's overall emission reduction goals. But on a national scale, the ETS is doing its job.
Earlier, you mentioned that the ETS had been effective in reducing emissions overall, but hadn't been so effective in balancing emissions reductions with economic growth. Do you think that the ETS is sacrificing economic growth in order to meet emissions mitigation goals?
No, that's not what we intend to say. It's just like we say that, for example, if the government could focus more on the five key sectors that we identified from the study, and that could give us more advantages in order to make this ETS more effective, there are so many sectors within the economy of New Zealand. So that means if those are the five key sectors that have been left out, not paying so much attention as it could be. So that's what we want to say.
How does New Zealand's emissions trading scheme fare when compared to similar models used by other countries?
Actually, compared to emission trading schemes that have been utilized in China and also the European countries, from an academic point of view, I think there's been a lot of extensive attentions have been received for those two particular countries or regions, but very few analyses have been done in order to make sure that New Zealand ETS is doing its job. So what we want to say is that we want to understand where the New Zealand ETS effectiveness comes from and also where it's lacking.
Based on your findings after completing the study, what's your opinion on the government taking agricultural emissions out of the ETS?
That's a good question. So I think that the government's move to take agriculture out of the New Zealand ETS and also create a new pastoral sector group in order to tackle methane is promising development. So it's a really good shift. It kind of like aligns with our research findings, our data and our conclusions, and also our key recommendations. It offers a really good pathway in order to more targeted and also effective climate actions. So for example, by removing agriculture sector from the NZETS and also instead focusing on tailored solutions, the government can kind of like support the agriculture sector's economic viability and also pushing for more sustainable emissions reductions. So what we suggested from the study is that the government could create a research hub, a technological research hub, in order to just like dedicate it to investigate what happens in the space of agriculture, as well as what should we do in order to reduce methane among all other greenhouse gases. So I think it's a really good move from our opinion.
Do you think that the new pastoral sector group would be as effective at tackling emissions as the ETS?
Well, I hope so, but I don't know much more details about like how they've going to manage and how they've going to conduct the new group. So I think it depends.
Do you think that taking agricultural emissions out of the ETS might remove the incentive for agribusinesses to switch to lower carbon practices?
That could. It's just not from a practical point of view, but purely from an academic point of view, is that what we recommend before the government implements such new move or policies is that we want to see from an economic viewpoint is that if we can offer a fixed carbon price ceiling, especially to agriculture sectors and also like farmers, so on and so forth, this could provide a more predictable cost structures for emissions and also could drive more significant reductions across all sectors, not only agriculture, because we've got some spillover effects. That's what we recommended from our study. But we don't really know. It's all depend on maybe like reactions from the farmers and then how they digest and actually what are the detailed movements that the government should implement.
The study mentioned that while agricultural businesses are one of the largest contributors to New Zealand's net greenhouse gas emissions, they're also one of the largest contributors to the country's export sector. Are agricultural businesses too important to the economy for the government to regulate their emissions the same way that they regulate other industries?
Yeah, that's right, because it's like pros and cons, right? That's why I think government is kind of like hesitant in order to put agriculture into the ETS straight away when it just like initiated this policy. But I do think that, as you said, agriculture sector is a really key, especially like for exporting. And then in order to make sure that the New Zealand economy is moving to the right and also positive directions. So agriculture is really important. That's why I think government is taking care of it and then making sure that they move it with caution and then carefully manage what we should do.
And finally, what are some changes that you think could be made to make the ETS more effective?
I think it's just like what we said is those five key sectors that we've identified in the study, that the government should pay more attention to those key five sectors. We're not saying that the other sectors are not important, but if we can focus more on the, for example, like right now is agriculture and then maybe transport, energy, petrol and diesel, and then waste reductions that could give us more disproportionate reduction goals. And then that can help us to achieve a more effective ETS overall.
That was Dr. Selena Shang from the University of Auckland talking to us about the government's decision to remove agricultural emissions from the emissions trading scheme.
Like, naked is the theme. Like, people just love getting naked.
Last week, United States bank Wells Fargo made headlines for firing a dozen employees who were caught faking work from home. Wells Fargo has started monitoring employees' computers, which showed software being used to establish fake activities from employees' computers. I spoke to the University of Auckland's Dr. Emmy Van Esch about this Wells Fargo example and the ethics of monitoring employees' computers more generally. Can you start by explaining why Wells Fargo fired a dozen employees last week?
Yeah, so this company, they're actually often featured in the news because of their unethical business practices, both towards their customers or their own employees. So this time they fired a few employees, I think quite a few of them, because they used clickers, they used a gadget in order to pretend that they are actually working at home. So these people had to work from home, but for some reason they were not always able to sit in front of their computer, and therefore they bought a gadget to pretend they were working.
This raises a lot of questions about managing productivity, but also companies can abuse these tools in an unethical way. How do we balance productivity with ethics of at-home monitoring?
Yeah, so actually companies do have the right to monitor their employees, but within certain limits. So, for example, they can do it if they want to protect company data or if they want to make sure that there is employee productivity, but they should also at the same time respect employees' privacy rights. So they should find a balance here. So I think it's very important that companies should only use tools that primarily empower the employees. So only use tools when they are there for like training or development, or if these tools are there to improve the employees' health, their well-being, or their safety. But I think these tools should not be used if they are being used to punish people, like if they don't meet targets or if they don't meet objectives, as is in the case in this company.
How can these employees who put unfair, or sorry, how can these companies who put unfair expectations on their employees be regulated?
Yes, so I'm not sure they should just have policies, I think, to make it more fair. Yes, I think this particular company has unrealistic expectations of their staff, and the staff, they feel like they cannot meet the objective. So the only way in order to survive, they feel like they need to cheat at work.
And this was obviously an example from overseas, but is this a conversation that's being had in New Zealand as well?
Yeah, I don't have that information to hand because I'm new to New Zealand, but I know that all over the world, companies are increasingly using monitoring tools to keep track of their own employees, especially because many people work from home. So companies want to check if they're actually working when they are at home. And also because of the rise of AI, artificial intelligence, so companies want to check if you did the work yourself or if you outsourced it to AI.
And is there anything else you think people should know about these kind of tools that are being introduced and what happened with Wells Fargo?
Yeah, I think this is just an extreme case of a company that is famous for not treating their staff with a lot of respect and trust. So I think usually when companies treat their staff with respect and trust, in return, the employees will also be nice to them. So I think it's just not likely to happen in most companies around the world.
That was the University of Auckland's Dr. Emmy Van Esch on the ethics of monitoring employees' computers when they are working from home.
Well, first of all, I love it. Clearly you've given up on trying to have any sort of neutrality in this interview.
The Wire.
We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the beat and text in your thoughts 5395.
I'm feeling good today. I ate before noon. I think that's pretty good. good for me. I'm gonna see my brother. He's got a new girl, but he's good at making time for me. I might open my doors. I got exterminator, so it doesn't matter if bugs come in. That way my dog goes outside. My neighbors know his name. Thought that was weird, but I'm over it. I got paid yesterday. I'll probably buy something dumb because I am pretty childish. But all my friends are the same. Just finding something to do. Find a new hobby just to ditch it.
Not your regular night at the movies. The Vista Foundation 48 Hours Auckland City Finals is on. Sky City Theatre, Saturday, June 29th.
Strap in for a roller coaster ride of laughter and thrills with 15 spectacular, bizarre and debatably genius short films made by local filmmakers in only 48 hours.
Plus, find out who will take out the Auckland City Awards.
The Vista Foundation 48 Hours Auckland City Finals. Sky City Theatre, Saturday, June 29th, 7 p.m. Tickets from eventfinder.co.nz.
Jazz Cigarette, Bob Hope, Dubage, Jar Rastafari, Wacky Backy, Mez, Mary Jane, Marley, Sheba Cheba.
What if you call it?
Muggles.
Marijuana Media has you covered. Every Thursday on 95BFM Drive, join Chris Fowley from Normal for the good word on law reform, cannabis in the media, and the latest in green science. Marijuana Media. 4:20 every Thursday on 95BFM Drive, thanks to The Hemp Store. Visit them at 253 K Road or shop online at hempstore.co.nz.
It's around, you know, up to 8 or 10,000.
Shit.
The Wire.
The rising cost of living in Aotearoa is pushing many families out of cities and bringing them to smaller rural communities and towns. The influx of new residents and housing developments in these areas is having a massive impact on the schools and teachers within those communities, reshaping the identity of the schools and the way they structure themselves. Otto spoke to Dr. Jennifer Tatterby, a senior lecturer in the Faculty of Education and Social Work at the University of Auckland, to discuss the impacts of urbanisation on rural schools.
So to start off, what kind of challenges are rural schools facing as a result of urbanization?
Yeah, I've sort of placed them into two categories. So one would be the immediate practical thing. So when they're experiencing this rapid rural growth, that means they have more students, and therefore they're experiencing challenges associated with getting enough teachers for those students, getting new classrooms, lots of new buildings, and more resources. And I think along with that, some of the things we often forget about in terms of, well, where do we drop off the students and where do we pick them up? So many schools have actually had to create these spaces. They've also done a lot of work with like roading as well and speed limits and putting in all those things in place to keep those children safe. But I just want to emphasize it's property. When you talk to any rural principal who's going through this, they need property services support to help them navigate these challenges that are happening really, really quickly. And Otto, just to tell you, like when I'm saying rapid urbanization, these housing developments pre-COVID were giving out 16 to 20 week builds on homes. So that means in 4 months, you could be having up to 50 new students at your school.
The study also talks about, you know, sort of like the intrinsic characteristics of schools and how urbanization is impacting this, particularly the ethos of care in rural schools. So how have the changes to schools and their rural identities impacted the level of care that rural schools are able to provide for their students?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I did think about that. So on one level, I mean, you can't deny that there has been a shift to that, simply because rural schools have what they often will call the sort of rural ways of being. So it's really focused on knowing your students and their families very well. Same as in other schools, but I think the difference for rural ones is that they know like their extended family. They might be the fourth generation that have attended that school. So I think they've had to rethink their identity and how they do that and do it in creative ways, just based on number of students. It just gets harder when you get bigger. And I think, again, going back to that idea of identity, I've called it a semi-rural identity because I had to sort of grapple with the fact that we now have students who might live in these new urban homes. And on the other end of the spectrum, they still have some of the existing rural kids who live on, you know, large dairy farms. And so having to come to terms with what exactly that looks like when you have a new mix of students with, of course, diverse lived experiences and home experiences as well. I think the principals, though, they talked about managing those expectations of parents and students. And so one of them, I'll just quote, she just said to me, you spend a lot of time consulting with families and growing a belief in what you do and why you do it, and helping the community understand the why around the type of environment and the kind of approaches that you're providing. So that's sort of that idea of not only rethinking this, but also educating people on what it means to be rural and what it means to go to a rural school. But then, although I guess on the third level, the answer would be no. I mean, they all proudly maintain this identity that we are different. We are rural, you know, and that means a lot of different things, but, you know, outdoors, but also, again, that community collective, and really clung quite strongly to that.
I think the study also talks about the role that schools and teachers play within the communities itself and how the teachers have quite a significant involvement in their communities. Has this rapid urbanization and the development of new housing in rural areas impacted this?
I don't think it actually has reduced it. In my study, from what I can tell, from speaking with the principals, the board of trustees, so like elected parents and teachers, and also the children themselves, the answer is no. In fact, it almost has increased that. Again, returning to the idea of how do you create and foster a new community with such divergent populations, they put in a lot of extra time and work into that. And the one thing I will always maintain is that in any community, the school is the community hub. It is at the heart of that community. So yeah, I mean, they've had to do it differently. A lot of the principals talked about a lot of these parents dropping their children at the local school and then driving long distances to commute into the city for work. So having some of those connections has had to make them rethink about how they do that. But I think they just readapted to what that is. And so they have that, again, that new way of being, but that has maintained that original rural identity.
Has the Ministry of Education provided rural schools with the resources they need to deal with the influx of students and urbanization?
I would say all the 18 schools that were part of my study across five different regions would warmly welcome additional support from the ministry to help with this, particularly around property development. I guess the one thing that I keep hearing from the principals is not only would they welcome this additional support, but they want the same property advisor. So one of my school principals in 5 years had 12 different advisors. And so you constantly have to tell the same story and have that person play catch up. So having longevity of people in those positions would be helpful. And also from a personal researcher perspective, I personally would welcome a conversation with our Minister of Education, Erica Sanford, and any of her team talking about what kind of research that I can assist with that would best support our rural schools, principals, and teachers and students.
Well, the study talks a lot about the impact of COVID-19 on rural schools and the ability of teachers to teach, basically. Could you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, I think it just exposed the already existing inequities that rural schools often face. And I think the biggest one is the internet. So everything went online. So let's teach online. This is a great way to do it. And for many, it was. But I think what was missing in there was acknowledgement or perhaps even understanding that for a lot of our rural families, they do not have access to internet. There's lots of people across New Zealand and rural communities who have no internet access. They don't have mobile phone access. So it was really challenging for them to, you know, learn. And for also for rural teachers who live rurally themselves to teach. So, I mean, how do you do that online when you're both trying to teach and also having perhaps some of your own children in that learning environment? The second thing that really came through was, again, more need for understanding of the rural context, because the ministry did a great job of providing resources like modems, for example, and digital devices, because not everybody had a device for each student or adequate numbers. But how did they get to these rural areas? It often came a little bit too late. So schools that I spoke with often put together their own learning packs and by themselves drove in their own utes or their cars or even on ATVs to hand deliver these packages to these rural families for whom had very little contact with the outside world because they didn't have internet or phone access. For many, the principal delivering something was the only other person that they had spoken to in several days.
As the pandemic headed into its endemic phase, as we could say, what was the return to the classroom like for rural students and teachers?
Yeah, I think like all schools across country, is a bit of a interesting foray back in. I think, again, due to the different level of access to learning during that time for our rural schools, I think it was just acknowledging that there was such a variety of different experiences of learning at that time. So some of my principals just literally said to their parents, you do the best you can. If you don't get to learn today, that's fine. You just look after yourselves personally as well as health-wise, and then we'll come back and start afresh. So I think it was a bit challenging. I know that some of my principals in the Christchurch area also talked about how there was higher levels of anxiety and fear and uncertainty because, of course, the earthquakes, you know, brought up some of the trauma or past trauma from there as well. So I think they did struggle a little bit, but I would say that's probably across the board, across New Zealand in many schools. I think it was just exacerbated by the such varied access to learning.
So finally, while we've talked quite a bit about the pressures faced by schools caused by urbanization, are there some aspects of urbanization and urban sprawl that have positively impacted rural schools?
Absolutely. So I think the children spoke very positively about being excited to be the new stewards of a new building or a new classroom. You know, they got to name these new buildings or rooms. I think the principals talked about, for many, the first time that they had enough people to form a board and have board elections, like that was really new and exciting. So more people, you can draw on different parental professional experiences, as well as just their own talents. They talked about having more hands on deck, if you will, to help with working bees, you know, to help out, you know, at the end of the year to refresh a building. And I think the children, again, really talked about how exciting it was to get new students in, you know, to form new relationships with people. We also saw an increased diversity in terms of cultural diversity of the new students as well. So bringing that into school, they were very excited to meet people from different cultures and to learn with them and also from them. And I think lastly, a lot of the boards talked about how they finally had a bit more support to put together projects that they'd be wanting for several years. So with those numbers, they were able to get new buildings, work on road safety, and other improvements around the school. So by all means, there are challenges and opportunities, just like any other situation.
And that was Dr. Jennifer Tatabir from the University of Auckland talking to us about the impact of urbanisation on rural schools.
Their relationships with their girlfriends or their wife. No one, they shouldn't have more than one wife at a time.
New Zealand recognises the threat of climate change to Pacific nations, but this is not reflected in our immigration policies. As environmental disasters increasingly impact the Pacific, many are calling for our immigration laws to be reviewed to make migration more accessible. I spoke about this issue with World Vision's Dr. Olivia Yates, and I started by asking why there is a need to introduce new immigration policy relating to climate change in the Pacific.
Sure. So currently, there is no international or regional or even national law that supports people to move for climate-related reasons safely and within the law. And what this means is that there is a significant gap in our legislation that forces people to rely upon existing immigration and migration laws in order to move for reasons related to climate change. And while at face value that doesn't sound particularly problematic, the real issue there is that a lot of these visas are primarily based upon employment. And as a result, people who may not meet the criteria that we have, for example, they have skills that aren't recognised as in demand, or perhaps they have a disability and so are barred from coming through our disability access criteria. They're not able to come to New Zealand or anywhere, regardless of the extent of environmental risk that they face. So we really think it's important for something to plug this gap, some kind of law to ensure that people can migrate if and when they choose to do so for climate-related reasons, but make sure that this can happen with dignity, safely, and within legal frameworks.
Should climate migration fall under existing refugee categories?
Our opinion is that this would not be ideal.
And when I say our opinion, I'm speaking on behalf of World Vision. Currently, the refugee quota system and the refugee system worldwide is primarily set up to focus on people who are being forced out of their countries by a process happening internally, whether it's a political conflict or a religious conflict or other discrimination. Climate change is a funny one. It sits outside of this because people aren't being pushed from inside their country, but rather they're being forced to leave through the actors that are states from outside their borders. In other words, countries who are creating the majority of emissions are creating the conditions that force people to leave. And so for that reason, for that first reason, we don't think it's really appropriate to sit within the Refugee Convention. But also on top of that, our Pacific neighbours have really resoundingly said they don't want to be called climate refugees. For our Pacific neighbours, having the label refugee implies many things that the world is giving up on taking action to support people to stay in place. And also it implies that there's a sense of forcedness that's beyond their control. They'd rather be seen as people with agency whose dignity is really guiding their decisions to move.
Other than on this point, have we seen many laws or discussions on this point from our Pacific neighbours?
Increasingly so. It's been a very contentious topic for a long time because of what I mentioned before around if we accept that migration is happening, there's a fear that this could dissuade those major polluting countries like New Zealand, like Australia, like the United States to focus on kind of mitigating the consequences of climate change rather than taking steps to mitigate the actual emissions that are driving climate change. But in the last few years or so, we've seen increasing focus on this topic that culminated with the Pacific Regional Framework on Climate Mobility signed last year, and New Zealand was part of this. This initiative came about through bringing together different state leaders from around the region and drafting together a statement, a guiding framework about what the focus is for the region in relation to climate mobility. And it covers a wide range of things. It looks at relocation of one community to another place within its own borders, all the way through the spectrum of mobilities to movement of people across borders. But across all of this framework, and kind of in reflection of the broader conversations happening in the region, there's a real emphasis on the importance of people having the ability to choose to stay in place and on their ancestral land, if that's what they think is best for them, or to move elsewhere safely, with dignity and regularly.
Is this exclusively an issue in the Pacific, or is this a discussion that's happening on a global scale?
It's definitely not exclusive to the Pacific. This is a discussion that's happening on a global scale and has been for some time. I believe the first mention of an environmental migrant in some way, shape or form was in, I think, 1989. And so it's been on the radar for a very long time. But, yeah, the global conversation around climate mobility is really underlining that response to climate mobility needs to come from multiple different perspectives, but primarily needs to be regionally based, location based. Recognising that each community, each culture has its own ways of understanding mobility and what is required of them. But there is, at a global level, increasing focus within, for example, the International Organisation of Migration and also within COP, the Conference of the Parties, that climate mobility also requires some kind of coordinated global mandate to drive these changes forward.
And on this note, should New Zealand be then doing more to support the development of international law to support the process of safe climate migration?
I think this is absolutely required. And in fact, it's something that our government has already committed to within their own commitments on climate mobility. This is MFAT I'm talking about here. They have committed to supporting and facilitating the development of stronger regional and international legal structures to support climate mobility. I believe that Aotearoa New Zealand has a really strong role to play in this because of our I guess, dual position, our conflicted position as a country who is a neighbour to the Pacific and whose Indigenous peoples, tangata whenua here, have whakapapa relational connections to the Pacific. But also the fact that on the global stage, we have a strong reputation as a country that's relatively wealthy. We tend to drive, from this position, we tend to drive action on climate change and in many cases seem to be a leader on climate policy. And so, yeah, I think Aotearoa New Zealand has a really strong role to play in making sure that this conversation continues moving forward, whilst also making sure that we focus on what are the needs and perspectives of those people who, for whom this is a present issue. It's not just an issue of legality, but it's really an issue of survival and of well-being.
I just want to finish this korero by bringing it back to the local level. How will New Zealand even be able to resource international climate migration when we're already seeing internal displacement, people being displaced within Aotearoa, and climate resources having to be allocated to people who are already displaced here?
That is a fair question, and I think it's something that merits further thought. But I think it also relates to the broader question around how we work with our refugee system and our immigration system to ensure that those who come receive adequate support. There's definitely enough finance that can be mobilised to support this. For example, and in relation to the broader climate change conversations, money that's currently going towards subsidising certain dirty industries could be shifted towards financing adaptation and mitigation in the Pacific. Climate mobility kind of falls within that. But there's also the broader awareness, and I think an important point to stress here is that immigration is a real backbone of our country's economy, and our government also recognises that, yeah, and continuing to invite migrants, refugees, others on the move is beneficial not only to our economy itself, but also to the social fabric of our country. And so I guess I would say there that it's not so much a question of how will we resource it, but rather how will we make sure that we resource it in a way that prioritises people's dignity and their well-being. And this is a question more related to morality and ethics rather than focusing on how we maintain and focus on a stable economy.
Lately, the government has been looking at and passing a lot of anti-migrant laws, including laws for things that seem very concept to New Zealand, like people arriving on boats, talking about mass migration and imprisonment of people who are arriving here, what overseas people are calling mass arrivals. Do you think there's any link between this new wave of anti-migrant laws and the predictions we're seeing that climate change will increase the level of migration to New Zealand?
Yeah, if we think about, I guess, psychology from a global scale, and this is me speaking from my background as a psychologist, the research clearly shows that the more people feel concerned about climate change as something which raises people's stress, the worry about their children, the more people tend to turn inward, focus on their own backyard. And we would like to push back against that mindset because it's really important that during moments like these, humanitarian crises, political crises, war, conflict, climate change, that we really lean back upon our shared values as New Zealanders, as pushing for hospitality without conditions, that we remember that, yeah, part of the DNA of this country is that we're working together for the global good, regardless of our small size. And so I think one of the things that we're seeing with this government and its shift towards what it refers to as rejigging our immigration system and really focusing on skilled migrants, we're seeing a shift away from welcoming all people and making it really conditional on people who fit this really narrow skill set. And I would argue that this goes against what it means to be New Zealanders, to be generous in times of crisis so that we can support the world, not just our own country, and making sure that everybody has a right to live with dignity.
That was World Vision's Dr. Olivia Yates, on why Aotearoa needs new policy pertaining to Pacific migration due to climate change.
So it's a very odd time to be alive, as they say.
The Wire. That was The Wire.
Ko era te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki. Nā te mihi kia koutou katoa I kōrero mai mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Wire for Rāpare Thursday. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. World Vision's Dr. Olivia Yates, Labour's Carmel Cepoloni, University of Auckland's Dr. Jennifer Tedeby, University of Auckland's Dr. Selena Shang, the University of Auckland's Dr. Emmy Van Esch, and Kanak Youth Coordinator Vero Hulue. Nei rā hoki te mihi kia koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4.
A 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.